Over the next 4 days, the prosecutor placed his witnesses on the stand. Tricia, Shaz's secretary, explained how Moses had gained entrance to the office suite in the guise of a chauffeur, and how, on the day of the murder, Moses had seized and bound her, how she had watched him fire the fatal shot that killed Colonel Malcolm S. Do you wish to cross-examine the witness? Judge Villiers asked, and once again Moses shook his head. Manfred Delarey gave his evidence and described how he had found Moses Garmer with the pistol in his hand and Blaine Malcolm S. lying on the floor dying. How he had heard him cry, "You! You!" and saw him deliberately fire the pistol at Shaza Courtney. "Do you wish to cross-examine the witness?" the judge asked, and this time Moses did not even look up. An electrical engineer described the captured equipment and identified the transmitter as being of Russian origin. An explosives expert told the court of the destructive power of the plastic explosives placed beneath the government benches. "In my opinion, it would have been sufficient to destroy totally the entire chamber and the adjoining rooms. It would certainly have killed every person in the main chamber and most of those in the lobby and the surrounding offices." After each witness had finished his evidence, Moses again refused to cross-examine. At the end of the fourth day, the Crown had presented its case, and Judge Villiers adjourned the court with one last appeal to the prisoner. "When the court convenes on Monday, you will be required to answer the charges against you. I must once more impress upon you the grave nature of the accusations, and point out to you that your very life is at stake. Yet again, I urge you to accept the services of legal counsel." Moses Garmer smiled at him with contempt. Dinner that evening at Veltefrieden was a sombre affair. The only one who was unaffected by the day's events was Gary, who had flown down in the Mosquito from the Silver River mine for the weekend. While the rest of the family sat in silence, each of them brooding on the events of these last days and their own particular part in them, Gary was enthusiastically selling to Santon and Shaza his latest plan for reducing costs at the mine. "Accidents cost us money in lost production. I'll admit that in the last 2 years our safety record has been about average for the industry as a whole, but if we could cut down our fatalities to 1 per 100,000 shifts or better, we could reduce our overall production costs by over 12%. That is £20 million a year. On top of that, we would get the added bonus of worker satisfaction and cooperation. I have put all the figures through the computer." Gary's eyes behind his spectacles glittered as he mentioned that piece of equipment. Shaza had reports from David Abrams and the general manager of the Silver River that Gary sometimes sat all night at one of the terminals of the new IBM computer that the company had at last installed. "Oh, the lad knows his way around the machine as well, if not better, than any of our full-time operators. He can almost make it sit up and whistle God Save the Queen." David Abrams had not attempted to conceal his admiration, and Shaza had remarked deprecatingly to conceal his paternal pride, "That'll be a redundant accomplishment by next year, when we become a republic." "Oh, Gary, you are being an utter bore," Isabella interrupted him at last. "All that business about tonnages and penny weights at the dinner table, what's more. No wonder you can't find a girlfriend." "For once, I think Bella is right," Santon said quietly from the end of the table. "That's enough for one night, Gary. I just cannot concentrate at the moment. I think this has been one of the worst weeks of my entire life, having to watch that monster with Blaine's blood on his hands sitting there defying us and making a mockery of our system of justice. He threatens to tear down the whole structure of government, to plunge us all into anarchy and the same savagery of Africa which rent the land before we whites arrived. Then he smirks at us from the dock. I hate him. I have never hated anybody or anything as much as I hate him. I pray each night that they hang him." Unexpectedly, it was Michael who replied. "Yes, we hate him, Nana. We hate him because we're afraid of him, and we're afraid of him because we do not understand him or his people." They all stared at him in astonishment. "Of course we understand him," Santon said. "We have lived in Africa all our lives. We understand them as nobody else does." "I don't think so, Nana. I think if we had truly understood and listened to what this man had to say, Blaine would be alive today. I think he could have been an ally and not our deadly enemy. I think Moses Garmer could have been a useful and highly respected citizen and not a prisoner on trial for his life." What strange ideas you have picked up on that newspaper of yours. He murdered your grandfather, Santon said, and shot a glance down the table at Shaza. Shaza interpreted it fluently, and it meant, we have another problem on our hands here. But Michael was going on obliviously. Moses Garmer will die on the gallows, I think we all know that, but his words and his ideas will live on. I know now why I had to be a journalist. I know what I have to do. I have to explain those ideas to the people of this land, to show them that they are just and fair and not dangerous at all. In those ideas are the hopes for our survival as a nation. It is a good thing I sent the servants out, Santon interrupted him. I never thought to hear words like those spoken in the dining room of Walter Frieden. Vicky Garmer waited for over an hour in the visitor's room at Rowland Street Prison, while the warders examined the contents of the package she had brought for Moses, and made up their minds whether or not to allow her to hand it to the prisoner. It is only clothing, Vicky pointed out reasonably. These aren't ordinary clothes, the senior warden protested. They are the traditional robes of my husband's tribe. He is entitled to wear them. In the end, the prison governor was called in to arbitrate, and when he finally gave his permission, Vicky complained. Your men have been deliberately rude and obstructive to me. He smiled at her sarcastically. I wonder how you will treat us, madam, if you and your brothers in the ANC ever seize power. I wonder if you will allow us even the courtesy of a trial, or whether you will slaughter us in the streets, as your husband tried to do. When Vicky was at last allowed to hand the parcel to Moses, under the watchful eye of four warders, he asked her, Whose idea was this? It was mine, but Hendrik paid for the skins, and his wives sewed them. You are a clever woman, Moses commended her, and a dutiful wife. You, my lord, are a great chief, and it is fitting that you should wear the robes of your office. Moses held up the full-length cloak of leopard skins, heavy and glossy golden, studded with the sable rosettes. You have understood, he nodded. You have seen the necessity of using the white man's courtroom as a stage from which to shout our craving for freedom to the world. Vicky lowered her eyes and her voice. My lord, you must not die. If you die, then the great part of our dream of freedom dies with you. Will you not defend yourself for my sake and for the sake of our people? No, I will not die, he assured her. The great nations of the world will not let that happen. Britain has already made her position clear, and America cannot afford to let them execute me. Her own nation is racked by the struggle of the American colored people. She cannot afford to let me go to my death. I do not trust the altruism of great nations, Vicky said softly. Then trust in their own self-interest, Moses Garmer told her, and trust in me. When Moses Garmer rose before the court in the golden and black robes of leopard skin, he seemed a reincarnation of one of the ancient black kings. He riveted them. I call no witnesses, Garmer told them gravely. All I will do is to make a statement from the dock. That is as far as I am prepared to cooperate in this mockery of justice. My lord, the prosecutor was on his feet immediately. I must point out to the court... Thank you, Judge Villiers interrupted him in frigid tones. I do not need to be told how to conduct this trial. And the prosecutor sank back into his seat, still making inarticulate sounds of protest. Heavily, the scarlet-robed justice turned his attention back to Moses Garmer. What counsel for the prosecution is trying to tell me is that I should make it clear to you that if you do not enter the witness stand and take the oath, if you do not submit to cross-examination, then what you have to say will have little relevance to the proceedings. An oath in your white man's God, in this courtroom with a white judge and a white prosecutor, with white prosecution witnesses and white policemen at the doors, I do not deign to submit to that kind of justice. Judge Villiers shook his head with a woeful expression and turned both his hands palms up. Very well, you have been warned of the consequences. Proceed with your statement. Moses was silent for a long time, and then he began softly. There was once a small boy who wandered with joy through a beautiful land, who drank from the sweet clear rivers, who listened with pleasure to the song of the bird and studied the antics of the springbok and pangolin and all the marvellous wild things. A small boy who tended his father's herds and sat at night by the fire and listened to the tales of the great heroes of his people, of Bambata and Sekukuni and mighty Chaka. This boy believed himself to be one of a peaceful people who owned the land on which they lived and were free to move wherever they wished in confidence and joy. Then one day when the boy was 9 years of age, a curious being came to the kraal at which the boy lived, a creature with a red face and a lordly manner. And the boy saw that the people were afraid. Even his father and his grandfather, who were chieftains of the tribe, were afraid as the boy had never seen them afraid before. There was no sound nor movement in the crowded courtroom as Moses Garmer described his loss of innocence and how he had learned the bitter truths of his existence. He described his bewilderment as the universe he knew was proved an illusion. He told them of his first journey into the outside world, where he learned that as a man with a black skin, there were places where his existence was circumscribed and limited. When he went to the white man's towns, he found that he could not walk the streets after curfew without a pass, that he could not live outside the areas that had been set aside for his people on the outskirts of that town. But most important to him, he found that he could not attend the white man's schools. He learned that in nearly every public building there was a separate entrance for him to use, that there were skills he was not allowed to acquire, and that in almost every way he was considered different and inferior, condemned by the pigmentation of his skin always to remain on the bottom rung of existence. Yet he knew that he was a man like other men, with the same hopes and desires. He knew that his heart beat as fiercely, and that his body was as strong, and his brain was as quick and bright as any other. He decided that the way to rise above the station in life that had been allotted him was to use that brain rather than employ his body like a beast of burden, as most of his people were forced to do. He turned to the white men's books and was astonished to find that the heroes of his people were described as savages and cattle thieves and treacherous rebels. That even the most sympathetic and charitable of the authors he read referred to his people as children, unable to reason or think for themselves, children who must be sternly protected but prevented from taking part in the decisions which governed their lives. He described to them how at last he had realized that it was all some monstrous lie, that he was no different, that because his skin was black he was not unclean or contaminated or childlike. He knew then for what purpose he had been put upon this earth. "I came to know that the struggle against injustice was my life," he said simply. "I knew that I had to make the white man who ruled me and my people understand." He explained how each of his attempts to get the white man to listen had failed, how all his people's efforts had resulted only in more savage and draconian laws, in fiercer oppressions. "In the end, I had to accept that there was only one course left to me. That was to take up arms and to strike at the head of the serpent whose venom was poisoning and destroying my people." He was silent, and his audience, who had listened in complete and rigid silence for most of the morning, sighed and stirred. But as soon as Moses Garmer spread his arms, they were completely attentive once more. "Every man has a right and a sacred duty to protect his family and his nation from the tyrant, to fight against injustice and slavery. When he does so, he becomes a warrior and not a criminal. I challenge this judge and this white man's court to treat me as a soldier and a prisoner of war, for that is what I am." Moses Garmer drew his leopard skins about him and sat down, leaving them all shaken and silenced. Judge Villiers had sat through the entire address with his chin couched in his hand, his eyes hooded with concentration. but now he let his hand drop, and he leaned forward to glower at the prisoner. "You claim to be the leader of your people."
"I do,"
Moses replied. "A leader is chosen or elected. How were you chosen?"
"When an oppressed people has no voice, then their leaders come forward of their own accord to speak for them,"
Moses told him. "So you are a self-proclaimed leader," the judge said quietly. "And your decision to declare war on our society was taken alone, is that correct?"
"We are involved in a colonial war of liberation," Moses Gama replied, "like our brothers in Algeria and Kenya."
"You approved of the methods of the Mau Mau then?" Judge Villiers asked.
"Their cause was just. Their methods, whatever they might have been, were therefore just."
"The end justifies the means?
Any means?" "The struggle for liberation is all. In the name of liberty, any deed is sanctified.
The slaughter and mutilation of innocents, of women and children, these are also justified.
If one innocent should die that a thousand might go free, then it is justified."
Tell me, Moses Garber, do you believe in democracy, in the concept of one man, one vote?
"I believe that every man should have one vote to elect the leaders of the nation."
"And after the leaders are chosen, what should happen?"
"I believe that the people should submit to the wisdom of their chosen leaders."
"A one-party state with a president for life."
"That is the African way,"
Moses Gama agreed. "It is also the way of the Marxists," Judge Villiers observed dryly. "Tell me, Moses Gama, what makes a black totalitarian government superior to a white totalitarian government?"
"The wishes of the majority of the people."
"And the sanction of your people, of which only you are aware, makes you a holy crusader, above the laws of civilized man?"
"In this land there are no such laws, for the men who make the laws are barbarians," said Moses Gama, and Judge Villiers had no more questions to put to him.
24 hours later, Mr. Justice André Villiers delivered his judgment to a hushed and expectant court. "The basis of the case brought by the Crown against the accused rests upon the consideration of how an individual reacts to what he perceives as an injustice. It raises the question of the individual's right or duty to resist those laws which he considers unjust or evil. I have had to consider what loyalty a person owes to a government, which was elected by a process from which he was totally excluded. A government which has furthermore embarked upon a program of legislation that will deliberately alienate that person from most of the major rights, privileges, and benefits of the society of which he is a member." For almost an hour, Judge Villiers enlarged on and examined this proposition. Then he summed up. "I have therefore reached the conclusion that no duty of loyalty exists towards a state in which the individual is denied the basic democratic right of representation. Accordingly, on the charge of high treason, I find the accused not guilty." There was a throaty roar from the body of the court, and in the non-white section of the gallery they were dancing and singing. For almost a full minute, Judge Villiers watched them, and those members of the court who knew him well were amazed by his forbearance. But the judge's features were crumpled with an unusual compassion and terrible sadness as he took up his gavel to quieten them. In the silence, he spoke again. "I come now to the other charges against the accused, those of murder and attempted murder. The Crown has, with the help of the most eminent and trustworthy witnesses, made out a case which the accused has not attempted to challenge. I accept that the accused placed a large body of explosive in the Assembly Chamber of the South African Parliament, with the intention of detonating that charge during the speech by the Prime Minister and thereby inflicting the greatest possible damage and death. I accept also that when his plot was discovered, he slew Colonel Blaine Malcolm S. and immediately thereafter attempted to murder Minister Courtney." The judge paused and turned his head towards Moses Gama, who sat impassively in the dock, still wearing his leopard-skin robes of chieftainship.
The accused has offered the defence that he is a soldier in a war of liberation and is therefore not subject to the civil law. While I have already expressed my sympathy for and understanding of the accused's aspirations and those of the black people whom he claims to represent, I cannot entertain his demand that he be treated as a prisoner of war. He is a private individual who, while fully aware of the consequences of his actions, set out on the dark road of violence, determined to inflict the greatest possible destruction in the most indiscriminate fashion. It is therefore without any hesitation whatsoever that I find the accused guilty of murder and 2 charges of attempted murder. There was no sound in the courtroom as Judge Villiers went on softly. The prisoner will rise for sentence. Slowly, Moses Garmer came to his full height, and he regarded Judge Villiers with an imperial stare. "Is there anything you wish to say before sentence is passed upon you?" the judge asked. "This is not justice. We both know that, and history will record it so." "Is there anything further you wish to say?" When Moses shook his head, Judge Villiers intoned. "Having found you guilty on the 3 main charges, I have carefully considered whether any extenuating circumstances exist in your case, and at last, having determined that there are none, I have no alternative but to impose upon you the maximum penalty which the law decrees. On all the remaining charges, taken jointly and severally, I sentence you, Moses Garmer, to death by hanging." The silence persisted for a moment longer, and then from the rear of the court a woman's voice rose in keening ululation, the harrowing wail of African mourning. It was taken up immediately by all the other black women in the courtroom, and Judge Villiers made no attempt to silence it. In the dock, Moses Garmer raised a clenched fist above his head.
"Amandla!"
he roared, and his people answered him with a single voice.
"Ngawetu! Mae Afrika!"